Okay, thank you everybody for coming here and managing to find an empty seat. It's a great pleasure to see such a big attendance for our event today. My name is Vasilis Manastriotis. I'm the director of LISI, the research unit we have here at the LSE on Southeast Europe. I'm pretty hopeful, I should say, rather sure that many of you know about our work in the Balkans and on the Balkans. Our topic today is on Montenegro between presidential and parliamentary elections. I have to start with a confession. As an economist, I don't know much about the history and the politics of Montenegro. Perhaps most of the things I know about the history are from people on the panel today. But Montenegro always fascinated me as the country that had all these things that seemed incompatible, like the political continuity, let's call it, for many years after the fall of Yugoslavia, but at the same time, the trajectory towards European integration, or the very good relations with financial flows from Russia, and at the same time, NATO membership, the mountains and the coast and the coast and so forth. So it is very interesting. I mean, you know, obviously a very interesting times for Montenegro, but very interesting also to see as a bit of an external, I guess, how things are developing in the country nowadays, but also what our panelists have to say on these things. I'm sure you know the situation in Montenegro, so I'm not going to introduce you to that. The speakers will do that. And we're very, very privileged to have in the panel people who, with real expertise, not only on Montenegro, but also on aspects that are very much related to the current, if you want, affairs in Montenegro. So I want to start by the order with which the speakers will speak. So, my right is Kenneth Morrison, who's a professor of history, yes, at the Montfort University. He specializes on modern Southeast European politics and history, with emphasis on Serbia, Montenegro, and Bosnia. He has published widely in his field. He's author of Montenegro Modern History, 2009, Sarajevo's Holiday Inn, with Palger and Macmillan, Nationalism, Statehood, and Identity in Post-Yugoslav Montenegro, in 2018, and more recently, the co-authored book on the Sanjak region. He has done a lot of work, not only strictly in academic outlets like books and articles, but also increasingly in things that sound very impressive from the academic point of view, with media and documentaries and so forth. So definitely a very, very important expert and contributor to the debates about Montenegro. Our second speaker would be Tena Prelec, who is a research fellow at the Department of Politics and International Relations at the University of Oxford, but perhaps more famously has been part of LISI here at LSE, as it say that. Her research focuses on issues of good governance and anti-corruption, and specifically on how transnational kleptocracy is enabled by the global financial architecture. She's conducting research currently on Russian foreign policy and illicit financial flows, working in collaboration with the University of Exeter, and specifically looking at the form that kleptocracy takes in Southeastern Europe, partly in relation to her work as a fellow at the Center for Advanced Studies in the University of Rijeka in Croatia. Tena has written widely on the topics of her specialism on the region, and also has a lot of work with policy and research bodies, including LISI, but also the BIPAC group, the Balkans in Europe Policy Advisory Group, and others, and she's also part of the latest cohort of Marshall Memorial Fellows, the development program of the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Last but not least, to my immediate left, is Neven Angelic, who is Assistant Professor in International Relations and Human Rights at the Regent's University here in London. He's also Visiting Professor at the University of Bologna. And Neven has, you know, this fantastic combination of not only academic inquiry and academic activities, but also a super extensive record of work, both as a journalist and as an activist. And sometimes these things all combine, I think, in interesting ways. So his career in journalism, heavy work for CNN, BBC, ITN, Channel 4 in the UK, and all the leading media in Bosnia and Herzegovina. But also he has worked as he's an activist for human rights issues in Bosnia, Herzegovina, and I think more widely. His latest book, COVID-19, State Power and Society in Europe, focus on Western Balkans, has been published in just last year, 2022, by Springer. So we have a fantastic panel to talk to us on our topic today. I will stay quiet for the rest of the for the next 40 minutes, I think, and then we will have hopefully plenty of time for your questions and answers, and we'll organize a discussion around our panel. Without further ado, Kenneth, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Vasilis. And thank you all for coming this evening. It's quite unusual for an event focusing on Montenegro to have such a huge attendance. So it's, you know, it's wonderful to see you all here, and wonderful to see some old friends here in the room as well. And hopefully we won't disappoint you with our analysis of the current situation in Montenegro. Now, not everyone will be so familiar with the kind of daily developments in Montenegro. So I'm going to begin by providing a little bit of context, i.e. how did we get to where we are today in advance of parliamentary elections that are likely to take place on the 11th of June. We've just had, of course, presidential elections. So I'm going to provide a little bit of context, explain the political situation, then I'm going to pass over to Tena. So over the past 2.5 years, Montenegro has seen significant political flux. In August 2020, the opposition, bolstered hugely by the support of the Serbian Orthodox Church, unseated the Democratic Party of Socialists, the DPS. And in April 23, just a month ago, Milo Djukanovic, who was the longest-serving political leader in Southeast Europe, lost the presidential election. He then stepped down as leader of the DPS. He'd been the leader of that party for over 2 decades. And he's a man who has held power, either as prime minister or president, roles he held interchangeably, with a couple of short sabbaticals in between, for over 3 decades. He actually became prime minister of Montenegro in 1991 at the age of 29. He's now, I think, almost 62, so it gives you some sense that he spent most of his adult life in either the role of prime minister or president. Now, that major political defeat, and it was a major political defeat, was inflicted by a relative political newcomer, Jakub Milatović. And after the defeat, Djukanovic resigned as the leader of the party, though he committed to remaining active within the DPS as a kind of elder statesman within it. But there's little doubt that the presidential elections marked a major shift, another major shift in Montenegrin politics, and one that has heralded the end of the Djukanovic era, and that era in which he was the dominant political figure in the country. Now, although critics of Djukanovic will find it hard to acknowledge, his political dominance over 3 decades has been marked by several notable achievements. In the years that followed the violent disintegration of the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, Montenegro avoided war on its territory. Then it remained, of course, something of a junior partner within what was a rather asymmetric federation, the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, and later the joint state of Serbia and Montenegro, the short-lived joint state of Serbia and Montenegro. But it was during the 1990s that he moved to take control of the DPS, which was a kind of monolithic party prior to 1997. He then enters into a conflict with Momir Bulatovic, who at that time was the president of Montenegro. And once he takes control of the DPS, he begins to reorient the party towards independence. Now, that came in 2006, following an independence referendum in May of that year. Montenegro reclaimed its independence and thereafter made steady and relative, albeit relatively slow, but steady progress towards European Union accession. It also became a member of NATO in 2017, although, of course, this remains controversial because there was never a clear public consensus on the issue of NATO membership. Nevertheless, for these successes, Djukanovic should be given credit. Now, he was a highly capable political operator, and he doesn't actually neatly fit the standard definition of an autocrat, which he was often accused of being. But he did preside over a period in which the strengthening and expanding of the partyocracy model in Montenegro, in which the lines between the party, the DPS, and the state became increasingly blurred. And this became more evident after the 2006 referendum. In essence, the DPS became a state party that forged a system in which the rules of the game were essentially rigged. And within that system, the emergence of a sufficiently strong, civic, socially responsible, and non-nationalist political alternative was essentially deprived of option. oxygen, sorry. Moreover, critics of the DPS have argued that their focus on identity politics, particularly in the last 10 years, have given sufficient oxygen to other parties, such as the Democratic Front. Because without the identity politics of the DPS, it wouldn't have been possible for the Democratic Front to generate as much momentum as they did. The pivotal moment came for the DPS in 2019, when it was decided that they would pursue this proposal to introduce the law on religious freedoms, and the subsequent protests that were essentially led by the Serbian Orthodox Church, known as the Litije, followed. That led in August 2020 to the DPS being defeated in the parliamentary elections. And this was actually seen by lots of people within the DPS as an aberration, that, you know, the pandemic was going on, the Serbian Orthodox Church were more involved in politics than they had been at any previous time throughout the 1990s, and certainly in any period since Montenegro had become independent, and that normal service would inevitably resume. Well, it hasn't. And what we're seeing now is a changing political dynamic in Montenegro. I'm going to explain very briefly why I think that's happening. Firstly, there's the generational dynamic. After 3 decades of Djukanovic's rule, the presidential elections essentially became a referendum on his personal political style, his achievements, and his failures. The outcome was not inevitable, but the margin of the victory of Jakov Milatović was quite surprising to many. The challenger, Milatović, possessed in abundance what Djukanovic did not. He was a fresh face, he was untainted by 3 decades of DPS rule. He represented or tried to convey himself as a new breed of politician, not only because of his relative youth, but also because he belonged to a generation born, raised, and a generation that reached maturity in Montenegro during Djukanovic's decades in power. Now, that generation doesn't remember the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia or the disintegration of that state or the tumults of the 1990s. They were brought up in the generation, they were brought up in the period of Djukanovic in the DPS. And as such, it's a generation that possesses a very different emotional attachment to issues such as sovereignty, identity, economic prosperity, and the very meaning of power in the Montenegrin context. Indeed, for many young Montenegrins, independence itself had become perceived as a DPS project in which the party leaders, apparatchiks, and their families had benefited significantly at the expense of the majority. For his part, Milatović's trajectory to becoming president is one that explains an awful lot about the current socio-political context in Montenegro. He emerged onto the political scene as a staunch supporter of the Litije, and by his own admission, returned to the country to be part of what he described as the magnificent Litije. After the August 2020 parliamentary elections, he became Minister of Economic Development in the government of Zdravko Krivokapic before forming Evropa Sad, or Europe Now, movement with Milojko Spajić in 2022. Following success for Europe Now in local elections throughout that year, Milatović then ran as president only after Spajić's candidacy was blocked by the State Electoral Commission on account of his dual Serbian Montenegrin citizenship. So what kind of president is Milatović likely to be, and where will he lead Montenegro? And I think this is the question that vexes all of us and the reasons that we're probably here tonight to discuss. Despite the rhetoric that the country will remain committed to the Euro-Atlantic path and that there would be no change vis-a-vis the country's recognition, for example, of Kosovo, or continuing alignment with EU sanctions against Russia, it's prudent to take his comments thus far in the many interviews that he has given since the presidential election with a healthy dose of scepticism. You will have noticed, those of you that watched the presidential election that night, the Democratic Front really saw this as their victory as well, because they had told their voters, because in the first round of the elections, the Democratic Front didn't get sufficient number of votes to go through to the second round. They essentially instructed their voters to vote for Evropa Sad. Those of you that saw the victory celebrations will have seen the people standing on the podium, and it was quite an interesting kind of lineup of, you know, who the contemporary players on that part of the Montenegrin political spectrum are. And, you know, the evening was accompanied by post-election celebrations marked by the visibility of Serbian nationalist iconography, symbolism, and slogans. So branding Milatović as simply as a Western-educated reformist and understanding him as such might be wishful thinking. Many Western countries have nevertheless expressed the hope that Europa Sad will be a third or a centrist force within a recalibrated political system. Now, uniquely, for the first time in Montenegro, what you do have is a DPS that is going to be much smaller, and possibly a democratic front that's going to be much smaller. There is space now in the centre for Europe now to create that. Now, there have been parties before that have attempted to build a kind of civic political parties that could populate that centre ground. Pozitivna, back in the early days after the independence referendum, Pozitivna were formed in 2006. And then, of course, URA. Neither have been successful in doing that. URA more successful than Pozitivna, but there is the space now. There is a recalibration of the political landscape, and that hasn't existed in quite the same way in the past. One word of caution. Europe Now is a party without a base, in essence. It doesn't have a base and a well-organized infrastructure in the way that the Democratic Front do with the DPS. And of course, in the presidential election, they were heavily reliant on the votes of the DF. So one can understand the concerns of the sovereigntist bloc. You consider that Milatovic is just a figurehead in a broader movement, which includes the Serbian Orthodox Church, pro-Serb parties, Aleksandar Vučić's government, and various academics and activists in Serbia. These people, they argue, are committed to clericalization and creating a situation in which Belgrade has a more direct influence over politics. And it's often cited that this is part of a broader process called the Serbian World, or the Serbian World Project. This, they argue, has essentially made Montenegro more vulnerable, not just to influence from Serbia, but interference also from Russia. But primarily, they fear that their achievement, regaining the country's independence in 2006, is in mortal danger. Now, in terms of foreign policy, Milatovic may be genuine in expressing a desire to maintain the current Euro-Atlantic course. He will remain dependent, however, on the support of those who don't necessarily share his views, and there are more conservative elements within Europe Now. Thus, it's going to be pretty interesting to see if, when, and to what extent his current rhetoric will survive the test of time, and whether it can merge intact from, among others, the competing pressures from the Democratic Front on one hand, and the firm nudging by his Western supporters on the other. Now, whether Milatovic is genuine committed to such ideals is still to be determined. His speech that he gave after his victory was conciliatory, and Milatovic was, of course, the central figures, but as I mentioned, the cast of characters that shared that podium have myriad and sometimes competing and contradictory aims, and these will become all the more evident, I think, in the weeks leading up to the parliamentary elections. They all shared a common objective in the opposition of defeating Djukanovic. And the opposition then, the government, since 2020. But now that the bogeyman has essentially disappeared, that symbolic figure that united them, in a sense, is no longer there. And I think we are going to see quite an interesting new political reconfiguration taking place. So the struggle for dominance, the basically parties are in campaign mode for the June parliamentary elections. It's commenced in earnest, and I think we're going to see a pretty fierce political battle in the coming weeks. It would appear, although there's no reliable data, no polls conducted yet, that Europe Now are the strongest political force in Montenegro. The DPS are now in a period of restructuring and are unlikely to be able to mount a serious challenge to them, though they will remain the largest party in the sovereign bloc, sovereigntist bloc. So the political landscape in advance of the elections is very interesting. Tena's going to discuss a little bit more about that political landscape before Nevin talks a bit more about what this means, not just for the region, but more broadly as well, geopolitically. So I'll pass on to Tena. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, Kenneth, for this wonderful introduction, also for putting us, so for gathering us here on this topic. It's really great to be back at ECE. And I mean, it's customary to say that an event couldn't be timed better, but indeed, this specific event couldn't have been timed better for me, because I've just literally come from Montenegro this morning, and indeed, yesterday I attended a conference at which both key political players of the moment, so the Prime Minister Abazovic and the President elect Jakub Milatovic were present. So I'm here really to give you perhaps my impressions and to start a discussion and a conversation, because I know that in the room there are a lot of people who probably know a lot of the ins and outs better than us, so I'm really looking forward to that discussion. But before, you know, talking a little bit of what I think their main messages are and how they might fare going forward, I just wanted to double down on Kenneth's analysis and on really highlighting how key this moment of August 2020 was for the politics of Montenegro. I mean, after that month, after that joint victory of the opposition, we had a few months later a poll that we did with the survey that we did with the Balkan Senior Policy Advisory Group had a result that in Montenegro, more than 80% of people believed in change through elections. That was really a huge, you know, percentage, and was almost double than the amount of people who believed in the same thing, so basically in democratic change through the ballot box in both Bosnia and Serbia. So it really shows you how basically there was a moment of big hope that things could go in a different way through a democratic process. Now, has it since then, you know, have the key people who have kind of won the elections then and had all this opportunity to make a real change, have they actually taken this opportunity and made a big improvement so far? I mean, looking at the results, it seems this is actually not quite the case. We have had a sort of Netflix thriller type of situation ever since then, literally one episode every day sometimes. We have had a lot of opportunities squandered, a lot of egos fighting one against the other, and basically, unfortunately, EU accession remained blocked. So I think it's also quite important to, you know, remind everybody that Montenegro is the front runner in terms of the sometimes forgotten at this moment EU accession process. So they have opened all the chapters. So if there is one country in the region that could give a glimpse of hope that the process is not dead, is indeed Montenegro. So after this, we had a situation in which we had a polarization of, you know, pro-Montenegrin. For the first time, we had also even quite, we could say, a Montenegrin nationalism opposing itself to the, let's say, Serbian nationalism. But despite that, despite this, you know, attempted polarization, despite the failures of the opposition, despite, you know, all these attempts, also even the fact that there was the war in Ukraine, which to some extent went in favor of Milo Djukanovic, we'll explain why later, the DPS did not manage to contain their fall. So the question here is why? One explanation that I might give is as follows. So very often there is this you know, impression that it was the Serbian Orthodox Church that made it happen, that it was this clash, and that, you know, this Zlitje and the movement led by Amfilohije was what made it happen. But actually, if you look at the data throughout quite a long number of years, you can see that the DPS started losing support quite a bit earlier. And yet, they managed every time to co-opt all the civic movements within their ranks. So actually, the big difference after August 2020 was the fact that URA, this small party, this really small party of which probably Dejan Abazovic is the longest serving prime minister with a smaller amount of support by now, but they really did play a key role, because by, you know, turning their backs to Milo Djukanovic, by trying at least to argue for, we're doing this in a pragmatic way, we're not, we're keeping, you know, our civic orientation, and we are pro-European, we're not pro-Serbian. Then there were a lot of controversies about that, but they tried to keep that line. But we are, first of all, against corruption. By doing that, and by opposing themselves to Milo Djukanovic, they were the, you know, sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, and things changed then. And also, I think it's important to note the Western support. So what I mentioned earlier, why I mentioned that the war in Ukraine played into Milo Djukanovic's main, you know, strengths in the West, is the fact that he's been absolutely shrewd and really, really able in presenting himself as the, you know, beacon of Euro-Atlantic integrations, the person who is able to bring Montenegro towards an European path, making everybody forget about the fact that, you know, in the period between 2005, 2006 and 2014, when he introduced sanctions against Russia, business was absolutely flourishing. And actually, it has never completely stopped. But so basically that, you know, relations between, we know it today, you know, that between Milo Djukanovic and Deripaska, who's an oligarch very close to Vladimir Putin, were very strong and assertive. So anyway, his ability to basically, you know, make the right choices, geopolitical choices in the right moment, was what gave him a lot of Western support throughout his political career. But I also think it's important to note that also this started shifting a bit. And even before the war in Ukraine, the fact that the US put a lot of focus on the anti-kleptocracy agenda, so meaning on cracking down on grand corruption and on how grand corruption is interconnected between, you know, developing countries and the West, made it also so that they made a priority of sanctioning individuals who are involved in grand corruption, which has happened in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And there was a lot of nervousism in Montenegro that the next to fall might be, if not Milo Djukanovic himself, some of the people who are very close to him, even members of his family. So that was even before the war in Ukraine. So at that point, I think the war in Ukraine kind of gave him, you know, a some a way to get up a little bit, but was not enough for the DPS to fall down. To keep afloat. Why? I think we need to look at the motivations of DPS voters. They are for sure varied, but a big chunk of it we can make it related to clientelism, right? So from the moment in which voters saw that the DPS was no longer, you know, the party that had the keys to all the institutions that could basically provide employment and security to their voters, that was the moment at which their a lot of their support also started shifting. So back to main messages of the political leaders yesterday and what I find positive, what I find negative, and what are the unknowns. The picture really is very much mixed. I would like to, you know, for once that we have an event on the Balkans in which we can be not completely negative, I would like to try to be not completely negative and say that, you know, the arch of political history of Montenegro is long, but it might be bending towards a little bit of good this time, let's hope. And there are some things which I find positive. One is this issue of polarization. As I mentioned earlier, so this manipulating polarization between Serbian nationalists and Montenegrin nationalists was one of the ways in which the extremes...
Montenegrins
are bad. We can discuss about that later, but one of the things that I mentioned is that I think that after August 2020, there was a perceived... increase in polarization from both sides. We can discuss later about the...
If you don't mind, let's leave the discussion for the discussion and we'll continue with the panel.
We find it a little bit insulting, to be honest, but it's fine.
Apologies. We'll continue with the panel.
The country wants the best for the nationalists wants the best for their
Yes, then I'll continue.
The prelates, you're doing marvelous. They just continue.
Thank you. So, without wanting to offend anybody's, hurt anybody's feelings, but I do stick to my, you know, characterization that the there was a perceived clash between, you know, kind of groups after August 2020. There was an increase of it. We've seen the effects of it. We've seen it at, you know, the 5th of September, the aesthetics around it. So that is, I would argue, a fact. What I wanted to say is a positive is that it seemed, that really this polarization is not, seems does not to be reflected in the political picture as it is now. So basically that we have the DF, the Democratic Front, the very much pro-Serbian, very much pro-Russian party that is lost quite clearly at the presidential elections, that is very much down in the polls. And at the same time, we have, you know, these, let's say, more centrist type of parties that are gaining, Europa Sad and Democracy, first of all. So the second point that Abazovic and Milatovic both made yesterday was that they really want to, you know, make this point that pro-European narratives are front and center, and that the influence of Russia is at a minimum. This is what they say, both of them. And third point is that this really clear anti-corruption intent, yeah? So Abazovic is still blowing his horn that by eradicating corruption and organized crime, you eradicated the other ills in society. This is how he wanted to present himself in the beginning. And also Jakub Milatovic, we know that, you know, he has a past as an EBRD official. So he makes this point that they will accept investments from a range of countries, but that they will make sure that rules and procedures are transparent. Okay. So I find this positive at face value, but I would also like to point at some problematic positive issues. First, starting from this anti-corruption intent. So the data that I have for last year is that real estate, clearly, you know, an area in which Milatovic himself yesterday said it's where corruption happens most of all, had increased hugely over the past year. And we have at the second point, in terms of countries of origin, the second spot is taken by Russia. So 61 million of investment from Russia. And overall, again, we have Russia as a second country of origin overall in terms of foreign investments. Yeah, 177 million came from Russia last year. Second, golden visas. So golden visas are these economic citizenship type of programs, which are very controversial because the European Union and, you know, other Western countries have finally come to the recognition that oligarchs and people with shady money are using these schemes to basically move themselves as well as their businesses and basically provides a great avenue for corruption. So Montenegro has finally closed this scheme, which is good, but between August and December last year, we have a situation in which 287 golden visas were issued, out of which 110 were from Russians. This is a period in which Russia was formally under sanctions by Montenegro. So, you know, these statements by both Milatovic and Abazovic that they are so much, going to crack down both on corruption and the pro-European, they still need to be backed up by facts. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt, but this is something that still need to go away forward to prove it. So I will, you know, skip a few points. We can get back to them at during the discussion, and I will come, yeah, just to the conclusion, which is basically the same question that that Kenneth asked himself. So the big question after the parliamentary elections is most likely going to be what kind of party will Europe now become. And that's going to be the big question, especially if the polls that we have from, they're not super new, but from last month, we have Europe Now polling at 40%. This is huge. So it's almost like we're seeing a new DPS forming, yeah, in terms of its influence. Will it be long-lasting or will it last for a short time? In the case that this, you know, new big kid on the block that has grown up now will be so long-lasting, what will be its way of ruling? Will they really, you know, come to a new way of doing things with integrity and transparency and live up to all these good intents that they are putting forward? Or will we have a situation in which basically, you know, one basic way of working is substituted by another one? This is something that we still need to see. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Well, obviously there is something in Montenegro, since so many of us gathered in this room that is slightly smaller than Montenegro itself. The space is contested here, so is something is contested, or several issues are contested in Montenegro. And I'll try to briefly address them because of the restricted time. What is at contest over there? Of course, there is a political contest, but also, sorry, there is ethnic contest that is present that influences the political contest and the outcome of this contest. It did it recently, and it is very likely to influence the outcome of the forthcoming elections. Then we can look at the religious contest, again, very much interconnected, and geopolitically determined future of Montenegro, and consequently we can look at the broader region, and actually we can look at Europe. If we look at the northern Syrian naval facility port that is used by Russian forces, and then there is a lawless territory to the Turkish border, from that point all the way to the Atlantic coast, actually all the way to the Kaliningrad in the Baltic Sea, there is only 21.2 kilometers that don't belong to NATO, that are not controlled by NATO, and that's Bosnian coast. We are not talking about Bosnia here directly, but this is something just to put into the context of why the questions have been asked about the future of Montenegro immediately after the elections, immediately after the presidential elections. Trying to address these issues, basically the European Union integrations, of course, they all verbally are supportive of future integrations, but politics of conditionality of European integrations in the past, as we know it, influenced decisions, for example, taking credits with Chinese and not with the European Union, that didn't eventually work well for the Montenegrin economy. Membership in NATO, well, it has been confirmed that it is going to remain. There are no examples of, examples that would suggest that Montenegro has serious intentions to question its future as member of the alliance. The Serbian Orthodox Church is a factor, despite the legislation, and I'll address the constitution shortly. And then, of course, the big powers, China, Russia, and the small powers, the neighbors. I tried to use the Montenegrin constitution in order to just present you with some ideas, and then it will be open for the conversation afterwards. I focused just on the basic provisions, the beginning of the Montenegrin constitution, and in Article 1 it states basically it's a civic state which is contested. Most of the articles in the basic provisions part of the Montenegrin constitution are contested. Territory is not, but is it civic state or should it be actually a state of constituent ethnicities? It's been introduced to the public debate, of course it is ecological, democratic, well, we all know it, like most of the other states, actually ecological is quite unique for Montenegro. Sovereignty, again, who is a principal bearer of sovereignty? A citizen. So citizenship, again, contested issue. Who has the right to Montenegrin citizenship? In post-Yugoslav era, it has been rather restrictive in granting dual citizenship, or actually naturalizing people, ethnic Serbs from Croatia, ethnic Serbs from Bosnia, who migrated to Montenegro. Again, we can see that this identity politics, ethnicity, is in the background of potential political voting at the elections, potential at the voting at the referendum that brought in independence. We can see that it's rather weird, 55% requirement for the independence referendum to be marked as successful. Why not 60? Why not 50? But basically the number worked very well, that those political parties that are perceived as pro-Serbian accepted it because they saw a chance of actually stopping a Montenegrin road to independence. Well, it's in the past now, it's over. We can see that these issues have also been contested. Then we come to the state symbols. Here we go again. I mean, it's entertaining to watch a video from a Montenegrin parliament where half of the members of the parliament would stand up for the national anthem, another half would turn back, and so on. The flag, everything is contested. So again, we come back to this identity politics that is very much present in Montenegro. Yet, at the same time, the nationalism that is present in this country, like in other post-Yugoslav countries, there is something unique that Montenegrin nationalism, in my view, is the only one that is inclusive, open to minorities. National minorities in London.
Take your questions, please. You know, allow the speakers to say what they want to say, and they will take questions. We'll not shy away from your question. Don't worry.
Yeah. Could I ask for the rest of you not to be interrupted We can come to the questions of nationalism. I would like to talk about this.
The opposing nationalism from the other side, and then we'll agree. It's just reaction, not nationalism, reaction.
In my view, I had similar online debate with some friends of mine who are very strongly Montenegrin. Proud Montenegrins, let's call it like this, they accepted it at the end when we went a bit deeper into this, that nationalism could be positive. So I'm not saying that it is negative, it could be positive. The positive elements are that it was open towards minorities, and minorities in Montenegro, looking at ethnic Albanians, ethnic Bosniaks, ethnic Croats, and those who also declared themselves as ethnic Muslims in Montenegro, they were very much strongly Montenegrin, supportive of Montenegrin ruling political parties, and have been part of the ruling coalition until the August 2020. So this is one of the elements. The problem with this is that the largest ethnic minority is not supportive of this, does not feel being invited into the kind of debate about the future of the country. So this will be in the background to this. We have, to go further, Montenegro is a republic, yet it has two capitals, old royal capital. Republic has old royal capital. It's a bit of a contradiction. It sounds nice for the tourism purposes, but so like many other elements, and we tried briefly to address the elements that when I mentioned the nationalism, that might be contradictions when trying to address them. Separation of religious communities from the state, that's another matter. Both my colleagues mentioned this, that the Serbian Orthodox Church played an important role in galvanizing support for the opposition, for the voters to actually cast their votes against Milo Djukanovic or against Milo Djukanovic's political party. There is, despite the constitutionally introduced separation of the church and the state, we see that the church is very much active, and not the Montenegrin Orthodox Church, but actually it is the Serbian Orthodox Church. It's a broad area. We could have separate session just on this, so I'll just leave it there. And then we come to the relation with the other states and international organizations, and this is something that right now, actually, in the United Nations Human Rights Council, they are debating the submitted report on Montenegro and human rights. And most of the comments coming from the member states of the Human Rights Council of the United Nations is about freedom of media and state of the prisons and torture in prisons, or the role of the security forces and the police in Montenegro. There are plenty, they are very diverse comments. Generally, one could say that they are positive, but these are the two fields that have been addressed by the other delegates of the other countries in the Human Rights Council of the United Nations. So coming to this, the membership in the international organizations and NATO in the constellation of the relations globally that we are unfortunately observing and witnessing what is going on, especially since February last year, but we can go back to 2014, or the questions of the new world order, whether the current world order could be strong enough to prevail and to remain as such, or is there going to be agreement on the new world order, and how many poles in this new world order are going to be. It does seem that few regions are being contested. We can talk about Ukraine or Eastern Europe as one of them. We can talk about the Caucasus as a possible another one, and Western Balkans for sure are there. When we look at the map, we can see that there are six Western Balkans countries that are outside of the European Union. Everything else, they are surrounded by it. But more importantly, there are three countries that are outside of the of NATO: Bosnia Herzegovina, Serbia, and Kosovo. And in relation to Montenegro, whatever political elite is in charge of the country, we can see that Albania has no quarrels in Montenegro, that Croatia, member of the EU and of NATO, has no problems with Montenegro. So the only potential problems, and even well, Kosovo outside of NATO with a questionable status because of lack of recognition by the whole European Union members and many other states in the world. But Kosovo finally sorted the questions of the borders, and again, no open issues. Bosnia Herzegovina has no open issues with Montenegro. However, the question is that Bosnia and Herzegovina, with its complex political model, that one entity, Bosnia and Herzegovina, actually was very much eager to change to support the change, political change in Montenegro, basically opting, coming from Republika Srpska, opting for the support of the pro-Serbian political parties in Montenegro. On the other side, in Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina, it's a very much open support for the large coalition led by Milo Djukanovic's political party that opened up to the Bosniaks living in Montenegro, opened up to the, all other national minorities with the exception of Serbs, and therefore there is a strong concern. There was strong concern in September 2020 after the elections, after the celebrations that were marked by nationalist slogans and Serbian flags celebrating victory at the Montenegrin parliamentary elections. It's again yet another contradiction. I'm running out of time. I'll just offer you something, my final thought, and then we can exchange our opinions later on. The president-elect, you mentioned 40% support, whether it would be the new DPS and so on. I'm guessing that perhaps we are finally getting into the position that the political spectrum in Montenegro will be divided into three. We'll have strong Montenegrin political parties on one end. We are going to have strong pro-Serbian political parties on the other end, on the opposite end. And in the center, there is an opportunity and the possibility for the young future president to get the support and organize political center, not unlike Macron in France. It's a newly created movement, political party, that proved to be successful personally. Now, remember the elections that came shortly after Macron's election as president in France, provided huge support, popular support for his political movement. It is a possibility, it is going to happen in Montenegro. Also in the past, Montenegrins proved not to use elections for the choice or political choice, but actually to determine themselves to side with the future winner. So basically it was more a forecast, a prediction, and to prove themselves that we are on the right side of history. Now, finally, after 30 years of democracy in Montenegro, we are perhaps entering the situation where a real political contest is going to take place.
Thank you very much to all of the panelists.